issue remains relevant to other scientific debates surrounding COVID-19 as well. In the spring of 2020, the FDA approved a drug called remdesivir, which it says shortens the duration of hospital stays for patients with severe COVID-19. Tens of thousands of patients were hospitalized in the United States and went on to receive remdesivir, including one of my family members. Yet the WHO conducted its own analysis and found that remdesivir offered little to no medical benefit. Does this mean that YouTube would ban advertisements for remdesivir from Gilead Sciences, the pharmaceutical company that markets it? Or take down academic presentations from physicians who find a medical benefit? Its decisions to censor doctors testifying about ivermectin, while permitting presentations about remdesivir, seem arbitrary at best. YouTube is hardly alone in its transgressions. Last summer, Facebook banned anti-vaccination advertisements and posts that were critical of lockdowns and mandatory mask orders. To discern real science from fake science, Facebook adopted a fact-checking program with independent third-party fact-checking organizations certified through the International Fact-Checking Network. Inappropriate content, as determined by this fact-checker Politburo, was either labeled as misinformation, deprioritized, or removed. To further sanitize the ideas that circulate on its platform, Facebook employed a hate speech engineering team to devise complex machine learning algorithms that discern between palatable content to promote to the top of its users' news feeds and borderline content to be downranked and relegated to the bottom. The idea cleanse is now complete, all the while unnoticed and barely detected as users mindlessly scroll down the page. Of course, the main objective of these large technology titans wasn't really the pursuit of science at all. It was partly about financial self-interest. Large publicly traded technology companies, as of this writing, have added over $1 trillion of market capitalization since the start of the pandemic in early 2020, an order of magnitude more than the GDP of most nations in the same period. Why? Because lockdowns meant more people decided to get their groceries on Amazon than to go to the local store, because more people were able to meet via Zoom rather than travel to a conference, and because more people chose to subscribe to Netflix rather than go to a movie theater. Meanwhile, small businesses across America suffered for the very same reason. It's no wonder that big tech stacked the decks of public debate to favor lockdowns, even as in retrospect, we find these policies were of dubious value in preventing the spread of COVID-19, while markedly effective in spreading economic calamity. Yet as tempting as it might be to pin all of this to the economic self-interest of large tech companies, that's just an asterisk compared to the real story: the pursuit of a monolithic political agenda. In modern Silicon Valley, money isn't even the main motivator anymore. That's where woke Silicon Valley today differs from woke Wall Street. The Valley's titans have more money than either you or they can imagine. Now, they're after raw power. MailChimp, the bulk email marketing company, refused service to the Northern Virginia Tea Party, citing that the group was spreading potentially harmful misinformation. The company also suspended an account associated with the conservative grassroots organization Engage the Right for hate speech. PayPal removed accounts belonging to certain conservative customers, a practice the payment processor has long been accused of by right-wing and far-right groups. Vacation rental service Airbnb banned Ronald Gaudier, a self-proclaimed Proud Boy, after an anonymous group on Twitter asked whether members of white supremacist hate groups were allowed to use the platform. These tweets were in response to a post from Gaudier announced that he would be attending a pro-Trump rally in D.C. and inviting like-minded individuals to join him at his rental apartment. Airbnb found the reservation, canceled it, and banned Gaudier indefinitely, and tweeted that members of hate groups weren't welcome on its platform. The arbiter of who counted as a hate group was, of course, Airbnb itself. The behaviors became even less veiled as the election neared. Just a week before the final ballots were cast, Expensify, an expense management software firm in Silicon Valley, sent a 1,300-word email to the company's base of 10 million customers, urging them to vote for Biden because its CEO was worried about America being able to survive another term of Trump's presidency. The email assumed a vaguely threatening tone, suggesting that a vote for anyone other than Joe Biden, including a vote for a third-party candidate, meant that you were comfortable standing aside and allowing democracy to be methodically dismantled in plain sight. I recently met David Barrett, the company's CEO, and I asked him whether he worried that CEOs like himself might actually pose the greater threat to the integrity of democracy. I expressed my view that our democracy worked according to a one-person, one-vote principle, and that CEOs shouldn't have a greater voice in our democracy just because they run companies. His response? I don't fucking care. He used the word fuck or fucking too many times for me to fully grasp the actual points he was making, if there were indeed any coherent points at all. When I tried to ask him if Expensify would bar customers who supported Trump, he pointed me to their policy barring hate groups and said that he would follow the definition adopted by the Southern Poverty Law Center. As a side note, the Southern Poverty Law Center is an entirely separate racket in its own right, a convenient front for woke corporations that fund it. Today, a nonprofit whose endowment exceeds $200 million and whose expenditures on fundraising dwarf those of normal nonprofits. A nonprofit that spends a ton of money on fundraising is the charitable world's equivalent of a Ponzi scheme, an ideological one run by woke capitalists in the name of social justice. The message sent by powerful technology firms to the American people was crystal clear. If you dare to do things like, say, transfer money, submit an expense report, rent a home, or send an email, you better have the right political views and be on the right side of politics, as determined, of course, by Silicon Valley itself. As the gatekeeper to the internet itself, no company was better positioned to implement these political values than Google. In the summer of 2020, ahead of the election, a curious trend emerged. In the first half of the year, individual clicks and impressions of the conservative news site Breitbart News, resulting from Google searches from Joe Biden, were steadily high. But suddenly, starting in the middle of the year, activity on Breitbart from the same search terms took a nosedive. Why did this happen? As it turns out, Google had allegedly kept a blacklist of right-wing conservative websites and news outlets to be suppressed from its search results. Breitbart was on the list. Dr. Robert Epstein, a renowned psychologist and a researcher and a Democrat, is a longtime expert on deceptive business practices by big tech companies and a personally motivated Google critic. In 2019, Dr. Epstein testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee and claimed that Google could manipulate upwards of 15 million votes in the upcoming 2020 election without anyone knowing they were manipulated and without leaving a trace. Ahead of the election, Dr. Epstein's team of 733 field agents were deployed in three key swing states. They preserved approximately 500,000 ephemeral online experiences and found that Google search results were strongly biased in favor of liberals. While bias was shown to every group in Google searches, conservatives were shown slightly greater liberal bias in their search results. Having already censored users and websites with impunity, social media giants then took the next major leap, censoring articles published by major newspapers. In the weeks leading up to the 2020 presidential election, the New York Post ran an article featuring Hunter Biden, son of Joe Biden. The article detailed the younger Biden's business dealings in Ukraine, purportedly trading favors on his father's name while the elder Biden was vice president. As evidence, the article featured email exchanges involving Hunter and a senior executive of Burisma, a Ukrainian oil company. The emails show that Hunter, then a member of Burisma's board, was made aware of political and legal pressure inflicted on the company by the Ukrainian government. According to the emails, Hunter allegedly brokered a meeting between the executive and his father after being asked how he could use his influence on the company's behalf. Contrary to reports that Joe Biden wasn't involved in Hunter Biden's business dealings, Tony Bobulinski, a former business associate of Hunter Biden, eventually stepped forward. In a live TV interview with Tucker Carlson, Bobulinski presented text messages that appeared to refer to Joe Biden as the chairman and suggested that he often weighed in on business transactions. When asked to comment on the New York Post story, the Biden campaign declined to deny the accuracy of the story. The Biden campaign and family also didn't dispute Tony Bobulinski's allegations. Whether or not the story is actually true is a separate question. I certainly don't know. Neither does Mark Zuckerberg or Jack Dorsey. It is noteworthy that after Biden won the election, the news quietly came out that the DOJ had been investigating Hunter Biden. Regardless, factual disputes like these are a feature of modern politics. The general public weighs different pieces of information from various sources, listens to the candidates, and then makes an electoral decision. That's how democracy works. Yet in 2020, that process was corrupted. Big tech quickly stepped in to suppress the Hunter Biden story and muzzled anyone who dared to probe further. Shockingly, Twitter decided to ban any of its users from sharing even a link to that article on its platform. It prevented individual users from sending that link to one another via private messages, taking the dramatic step of intervening even in non-public one-on-one communications. Worst of all, Twitter froze the entire account of the New York Post altogether. A 21st century Silicon Valley giant, run by a multi-billionaire bearded self-fashioned Buddhist guru, single-handedly censored America's fourth largest newspaper by circulation, an institution that had been founded over two centuries ago by Alexander Hamilton. Twitter also suspended the personal accounts of certain editors and journalists who worked at the newspaper. Facebook quickly followed suit and also decided to limit the distribution of the Hunter Biden article. Together, Facebook and Twitter comprise the two biggest social media platforms, and both of them effectively decided what information was made available for the American electorate in advance of an election. That's particularly arresting when it involved a story about one of the two candidates in the election, and in retrospect, the one who emerged as the winner. During Senate testimony in response to a probe surrounding these issues, Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey feigned humility, effectively saying, "We screwed up with respect to the company's handling of the New York Post's Hunter Biden story." Dorsey claimed that blocking the article was in accordance with Twitter's policies with respect to materials obtained through hacking, while expressing contrition for making a hasty decision without sufficient evidence. Mark Zuckerberg was similarly self-critical. But don't be fooled by their practiced vulnerability. Was it merely a coincidence that Facebook and Twitter adopted the exact same policies with the exact same political effect at the exact same time? Nope. This wasn't a case of two bumbling gentle giants that simply couldn't get out of their own way. It was a case of nefarious coordination. Silicon Valley's chokehold over our marketplace of ideas is fundamentally different in kind from the scammy kind of woke capitalism, what I like to call corporate social irresponsibility, or CSI. CSI is fundamentally about inauthenticity. It's about using trendy social values as a trick to generate more profits. Profit became a bad word after the 2008 financial crisis. Greed was no longer good. CSI was just the natural response of corporations, creating a new narrative of social purpose to disguise their old school greed. The social causes simply serve as a form of reputational laundering for those same companies profit seeking. That's what most Wall Street banks and big pharma companies do today, for example. It's Goldman Sachs preaching about diversity so it can be at the front of the line for the next government bailout. It's AstraZeneca waxing eloquent about climate change so it can secure multi-billion dollar government contracts for vaccine production. It's State Street building feminist statues to detract attention from wage discrimination lawsuits from female employees, all the while marketing its exchange-traded fund with the ticker SHE. It's Chamath Palihapitiya founding a social impact investment fund and criticizing Silicon Valley, even though he and his wealth are products of Silicon Valley, all to cover up for his prior tenure as an executive at Facebook who dreamed out loud about a private corporate military. Those companies and people use their market power to prop up woke causes as a way to accumulate greater political capital, only to later come back and cash in that political capital for more dollars. To be sure, CSI is itself toxic for American democracy. It causes Americans and our government to vest too much trust in these corporations, only to later be scanned by them for an extra buck at a later date in one form or another. But what we see today from Silicon Valley is something different altogether. Twitter and Facebook weren't just distracting the public from their profitable cash-generating machines when they intervened in the 2020 presidential election in the sweeping ways that they did. They weren't just practicing CSI. Rather, their interventions were actually about legislating the value system and set of beliefs of their leaders, rendering our democratic process irrelevant. Why? For most Americans, the rate limiter for what they can buy is the amount of money that they have. but for multi-billionaires like Zuckerberg and Dorsey, the rate limiter is different. It's not the amount of money they have, since that's effectively infinite. Rather, it's the limitation on the scope of what money itself can buy. For a working-class family, a normal struggle might be how to save up to buy a house or a new car. For Zuckerberg and Dorsey, their struggle is different. It's to figure out how money itself can buy more things, since they already have a limitless supply of it. This may be more authentic than the scammy kind of woke capitalism that I described earlier, but it's even more dangerous. And it's also worse than the crude monopolistic pricing practices used in prior centuries by robber barons such as John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie. This expansive new form of woke capitalism poses the greatest long-run threat to all of American democracy itself. Worst of all, big tech today is keenly aware of brewing populist ire against its tyrannical practices, and it has discovered the perfect lightning rod for that ire, antitrust law. If that sounds confusing, you're right. Antitrust law was supposed to be the government's stick against big business. But for Silicon Valley, antitrust law is a mousetrap, one that politicians on both sides are falling right into. Right-wing populists like Josh Hawley, as well as liberals like David Cicilline, wrongly view antitrust law as the solution to the problem of the growing power of today's tech titans, just as it was used to rein in the classical robber barons in prior centuries. But they're wrong. There's a tactic in warfare known as a feigned retreat, in which one side leads another to a destination that's actually a trap. That's exactly what big tech is doing to lawmakers and the Justice Department's antitrust division today. And it's playing politicians on both sides by acting frightened of antitrust. Here's why. Antitrust law was designed to protect consumers from monopolies and cartels that use market power to limit consumer choice and charge higher prices. But today's big tech titans, companies like Apple, Microsoft, Google, Facebook, and Amazon, provide consumers with a wider range of products than ever before and for strikingly low prices. Twitter, Facebook, and Google are all free for users. Consumers can find pretty much anything they want on Amazon or at the Apple iTunes store. That's why tech CEOs ran circles around the House Judiciary Committee's antitrust subcommittee in hearings of August 2020. They'll likely do the same thing in court if they're ever charged with antitrust violations. The real catch is this. The same companies that have improved consumer access and lowered the prices of technology are also the ones limiting options in the marketplace of ideas and raising the cost of ideological dissent. That's not the classic antitrust violation of price fixing. It's what I call idea fixing. Antitrust law was designed to protect consumers from companies who abuse their market power to beget more market power. That was a distinctly 19th century problem. But that's not the main problem with Silicon Valley's behavior today. The main issue today centers on companies abusing their market power to beget greater social, cultural, and political power. The main victim isn't the consumer in the market, it's the citizen in our democracy. Neither the original antitrust statutes like the Sherman Act, nor the revisionist judicial logic of more recent antitrust scholars like Robert Bork, was designed or equipped to tackle this uniquely 21st century conundrum. That leads to a classical error made by professional politicians, using yesterday's toolkits to fight tomorrow's problems. There's a children's story about a character called Br'er Rabbit, who pleads, "Please don't throw me into the briar patch," to get a predator to throw him into one so that he can escape. Big tech's just saying, "Please don't throw me into that antitrust investigation," so it can point to its low prices and escape from having its idea fixing regulated. The rise of wokenomics consummates Silicon Valley's coup over our democracy. Censorship becomes rebranded as social responsibility. Refusing to run ads is praised as a form of corporate restraint. Yet the stakeholderist cheerleaders miss the bigger point. Companies like Facebook and Google have effectively assumed the role of the state itself and have further expanded that role to regulating and censoring public opinions in ways that no governmental actor can. Their exercise of power over the content of public discourse is without precedent in human history. In 1924, U.S. Secretary of Commerce and future U.S. President Herbert Hoover contended, It cannot be thought that any single person or group shall ever have the right to determine what communication may be made to the American people. We cannot allow any single person or group to place themselves in the position where they can censor the material which shall be broadcasted to the public. He was prescient, yet wrong. Less than a century later, Silicon Valley does exactly as Hoover feared, but on a scale he could not have imagined. In the lead-up to the 2020 presidential election, President Hoover surely did a few backflips in his grave. But he certainly did a few more backflips in the months following the presidential election. Consider what happened in January 2021 in the aftermath of the Capitol riot. A deplorable and disgraceful assault on our democratic process by misguided rioters in Washington, D.C., was met in kind with big tech's deliberate and coordinated assault on personal freedoms. Just as the military-industrial complex seized on 9/11 to implement a permanent new surveillance state beginning in the early 2000s, the newly ascendant woke industrial complex in America seized on January 6th to do something similar. Based on tenuous charges of incitement to violence and hate speech, Facebook and Twitter banned, suspended, and removed accounts associated with Donald Trump, the sitting U.S. president, including the official White House and the official President of the United States Twitter accounts. To top it off, Facebook enacted a new policy in March of 2021 that it would not only block President Trump from accessing his own account, but would also prohibit anyone from posting a video in the voice of Donald Trump, more reminiscent of Orwellian fiction than American reality. To make matters worse, the week after suspending President Trump indefinitely, Facebook resorted to its preferred remedy, an independent committee. Facebook appeared to delegate all responsibility for the Trump suspension to the Oversight Board, that is, an independent group, conveniently founded and funded by Facebook. The Oversight Board will render a decision on whether President Trump's suspension will be overturned, a decision that will be binding on Facebook. So just to clarify, a Facebook-created committee gets to pass judgment on whether Facebook acted appropriately. That's the modern world. The 45th president of the United States is relegated to appealing not to the U.S. Supreme Court, but to Facebook's Supreme Court in order to communicate via social media. So what did this oversight board decide? In May of 2021, it upheld Trump's ban from Facebook and Instagram, which Facebook owns, but it also criticized Facebook for its indeterminate and standardless response. They were applauded for their balanced approach. It was the best of all worlds for Facebook. The board upheld Facebook's decision in substance, but with that classic jujitsu-like move of self-criticism to confer a veneer of legitimacy to its own actions. It reminded me of a kid in my high school French class who used to cheat by stealing the answer key to every test, except he would always intentionally write the wrong answer to just one question each time, as a decoy to prevent him from getting caught. In an embarrassing display of conformity, YouTube, Snapchat, Stripe, PayPal, Shopify, and other platforms quickly followed suit with their own Trump bans. Of course, there was no hope for Trump's supporters or sympathizers if the 45th president himself wasn't immune to this brazen censorship. Naturally, the accounts of tens of thousands of conservatives also disappeared into the ether, all at the behest of technocratic autocrats like Zuckerberg and Dorsey. While Americans are supposed to enjoy due process and the presumption of innocence in daily life, they enjoy no such luxury in their online lives. Today's technology tyrants deploy a censor-first mentality and operate under the principle that certain people are probably guilty, that they are probably violating the ever-changing terms and conditions. This approach gives them the license to silence voices with whom they do not agree. Sure, sometimes that can mean they get it wrong. So conveniently, whenever they're caught red-handed or the uproar risks being too costly, today's social media giants now have a new refrain. Oops, we just made a mistake. In March 2021, Dorsey testified at another congressional hearing, this time on misinformation and social media. Dorsey admitted that Twitter's ban of the New York Post's Hunter Biden story was a total mistake, while denying that Twitter has a censoring department. The prior week, on the same day, House Democrats introduced a resolution to expel U.S. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene from Congress, Twitter locked Green out of her Twitter account for 12 hours by mistake. Twitter claimed that its algorithm-based rule enforcement mechanisms were to blame for the error. The following month, Twitter made another mistake and suspended Congresswoman Green for the second time in just a few weeks. Her crime? Tweeting, "He is risen," on Easter. But weren't these actions simply limited to white nationalist domestic terrorist lunatics? Didn't they all deserve it for spreading misinformation, stoking violence, and encouraging insurrection? Wrong. In one of its more egregious actions, in January 2021, Facebook blocked access to Dr. Ron Paul, one-time presidential candidate for the Libertarian Party, an OBGYN physician, and one of the greatest advocates for social liberties of Americans. Facebook cited no explanation other than repeatedly going against our community standards. Paul said he never received notice of violating community standards, and nowhere is the offending post identified. Curiously, these errors are consistently limited to one side of the political spectrum. The scariest fact of all is the way that most people uncritically accept these companies' judgments at face value, even when the companies later admit they were wrong. Immediately after Ron Paul was locked out of his Facebook account, here's what the founder of another multi-billion dollar healthcare company emailed me. "I guarantee you, Ron Paul's account was locked because he was saying something insanely inaccurate and unsafe about coronavirus." Of course, he didn't bother emailing me afterward once Facebook said it was an error. People said similar things about Marjorie Taylor Greene too, and I doubt they noticed Twitter's subsequent correction. In both cases, the damage was already done, and even worse, these incidents revealed just how much everyday Americans trust these behemoths. Errors or not, this broad wave of deplatforming didn't just happen to prominent politicians who at least had other avenues for voicing their grievances. It happened to ordinary Americans too, in shocking numbers. The message was clear: comply or we'll shut you up permanently. It was nothing short of a Soviet-style purge of political dissent. Well, doesn't the free market provide a solution? It did, at least for a hot second, in the form of Parler, a Twitter alternative popular with conservatives. Unlike big tech social media incumbents, Parler didn't harvest user data and didn't regulate political content. Instead, Parler set out to value, of all things, free speech and open dialogue. Parler was earnest. Ultimately, it paid a hefty price for its naivete. Following the Capitol riot, Parler was blocked from being downloaded from Google's Play Store, was suspended from Apple's App Store, and lost access to Amazon Web Services, all based on hackneyed allegations similar to those levied against President Trump. Big tech may permanently put Parler out of business. As it turns out, the free market is no match for the monopoly of ideas. This isn't about silencing conservatives. That's just how they get you on board with the idea of censorship. But once it becomes acceptable to silence people under the banner of fighting hate speech, whatever speech powerful interests dislike becomes hate speech. Unfortunately, it looks like we've already opened Pandora's box. I had a long call with one of Silicon Valley's most prominent venture capitalists on a Saturday night during the peak of the ideological purge in January of 2021. He's served on the boards of some of the largest tech giants. He explained to me with alarming clarity that there are about 50 pieces of infrastructure that comprise the modern internet, and that every single one of them, from individual browsers to cloud computing, serves as a node to effectuate political censorship, and each could be used to banish defectors from the ideological cartel in the future. In a subsequent text exchange, he called it the issue of our time. Yet despite being a famous jillionaire himself, he was also personally frightened. When I asked him what we could do to stop the tide, he immediately requested that I not cite his name publicly for fear of retribution. He acknowledged that his inability to speak up was a case in point of the underlying problem, but he felt the personal risks to him were just too great. So I wondered who or what would be the next target. If Twitter has a moral obligation to censor misinformation and offensive speech in public tweets and private direct messages, does Google have an obligation and therefore justification to censor private emails? Will Verizon say it has a responsibility to stop hate and conspiracy from spreading via text messages? If text messages become fair game, then why not live phone conversations too? This isn't just a matter of hyperbole. Earlier this year, at the 2021 Game Developers Conference Showcase, Intel revealed new technology that uses artificial intelligence to get rid of other gamers' hateful and abusive audio chat. The new product is called Bleep. This piece of software allows users to screen out white nationalism, aggression, LGBTQ+ hate, or racism and xenophobia. But who decides what counts as racist or xenophobic for the purpose of training the artificial intelligence algorithms? Of course, Intel Corporation. Is it really such a stretch to believe that this kind of technology couldn't easily be incorporated into our iPhones and email accounts too? Nowadays, concepts like racism and sexual exploitation are regularly being used to censor content not just for political reasons, but for commercial reasons too. Just look at what happened earlier this year to online chat groups focused on trading stocks. Early in 2021, a group of traders on a Reddit forum called Wall Street Bets realized Wall Street might have made a mistake. As it turns out, hedge funds had short-sold more shares of struggling video game retailer GameStop than actually existed. Short selling means borrowing a share of a company and then selling it in the market. It's a way of betting against a stock. The short seller makes money when the share price of a company goes down, allowing the short seller to buy back the share at a lower price and return it to the lender. Predictably, short selling isn't very popular with the public for the same reason that predators and scavengers aren't popular in nature. But in reality, they all have proper roles to play in their respective ecosystems. Predators prevent rodent infestations, scavengers clean up carcasses, and short sellers help prevent asset bubbles. That's why I don't think it's inherently bad, as some populists on both the left and right do. But like all investors, short sellers are often wrong. They lose a lot of money when a company's share price goes up. The Reddit crowd realized that if they just bought a ton of GameStop shares, they could drive the price up by so much that the short sellers would be forced to buy shares at the higher price to close their positions. That's how the mechanics of short selling work. And would have to pay whatever price the Reddit guys named. That's called a short squeeze, and it worked wonders. GameStop's share price skyrocketed. Hedge funds bled. The hedge fund Melvin Capital, led by one-time star trader Gabe Plotkin, was down over 50% in the month of January as a consequence, a staggering loss for a fund of its kind. It seemed like the Reddit traders had won, but the tide turned in the other direction on January 28th. Robinhood, the Reddit crowd's favorite brokerage, prevented all of its users from buying GameStop while still allowing them to sell. Robinhood claimed it did that to protect its users, seemingly unaware that when people are allowed to sell a stock but not buy it, it drops. That in turn panicked other retail traders into selling their own shares too. Robinhood pointed to complicated regulatory reasons about margin requirements for why it had to halt people from buying GameStop. In those rare situations, a brokerage might ordinarily halt trading in a particular stock. But that doesn't explain why they selectively halted just buying activity while still permitting selling. I worked at a hedge fund for 7 years myself, and I never saw that happen once in my career. At the end of the day, it isn't rocket science. If you prevent people from buying a stock and only permit them to sell, the stock will go down. And that's exactly what happened. Of course, Reddit traders were still free to use brokerages other than Robinhood to buy stocks if they wanted to, including in a coordinated fashion. But this is where wokeness comes in. Just hours before the Thursday short-selling onslaught, the online chat company Discord shut down a Wall Street Bets discussion server with 250,000 members over allegations of hate speech. Wall Street Bets moderators claimed the entire Discord server was banned because one user had managed to bypass a filter for vulgarity. Simultaneously, Facebook shut down a 150,000-strong discussion page for Robinhood traders over allegations of adult sexual exploitation, which it refused to substantiate. It was a ridiculous claim even on its face. So when Robinhood locked them out of buying the next day and GameStop plummeted, the retail traders were left silenced and alone, allowed only to sell. Most of them didn't. When reporters asked the White House to comment on the GameStop drama, wokeness surfaced yet again. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki responded by saying, "I'm happy to repeat that we have the first female Treasury Secretary, and she's monitoring the situation." In other words, we're not going to answer your question about all that stock stuff, but the important thing to remember is that we've got a female Treasury Secretary out there breaking glass ceilings. You can't make this stuff up. The really important thing to remember here is that big tech's idea fixing isn't just about silencing conservatives. That's only where it started. But it evolved just weeks later. Corporate America acclimated regular Americans into accepting its censorship by banning hate speech from conservatives. Right after that, when stock traders on Reddit and Facebook were saying things it didn't want them to say, it immediately used its newfound power to ban them for hate speech and sexual exploitation too, even though those things had nothing to do with it. And the purview of the ideological purge continues to expand further every day. If socialists and MAGA conservatives agree on anything, it's that the rise of the Silicon Leviathan is a threat to America. This January, following Robinhood's decision to halt its users' ability to buy GameStop shares, lawmakers from across the political spectrum condemned the move and called for hearings into the decision, including staunch conservative Ted Cruz and ultra-liberal Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. The conservative attorney generals in Texas and the progressive attorney general in New York both initiated inquiries into Robinhood with equal vigor. Even in August 2019, the House Judiciary Antitrust Subcommittee grilled big tech CEOs so aggressively that a political layperson couldn't have guessed which participants were Republican and which ones were Democrats. They disagree only in their diagnosis of the problem. Liberals allege that this grim reality is simply the inevitable outcome of the free market, while classical conservatives say the answer is that we don't have enough competition in the marketplace, even though they don't have a coherent account as to why. Who's right? My view? Neither. The real culprit is actually Congress itself. Our federal laws continue to aid and abet the rise of Silicon Valley's behemoths in the form of unique corporate privileges enjoyed by internet companies that have successfully lobbied our lawmakers for competitive advantages that wrongly favored Silicon Valley over the rest of America. The emergence of these corporate monsters isn't a product of capitalism, but instead the laws and regulations that are vestiges of crony capitalism. The most important of these laws is Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act of 1996, which confers a broad shield of legal immunity specifically to Silicon Valley titans, internet service providers, like Facebook and Twitter, for all content published on their platforms. Notably, this is a tremendous benefit that ordinary publishers of content don't enjoy. For example, my hometown's newspaper, the Cincinnati Inquirer, or even the publisher of this book, Hachette Book Group. Those who are familiar with this law in Silicon Valley generally agree that companies like Google, Facebook, and Twitter would have never become the large-scale behemoths they did without Section 230. The irony is that they generally cite that fact as an argument in favor of Section 230, not as an argument against it. Before going further, it's worth pausing to note what Section 230 actually says. The law has two key provisions. Section 230(c)(1) says that platforms are not to be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by their users. This means that if someone tweets something disparaging about you on Twitter, you can sue that person, but you can't sue Twitter. Section 230(c)(2) is the so-called Good Samaritan provision, which immunizes platforms from liability for any action voluntarily taken in good faith to restrict access to or availability of material that the provider or user considers to be obscene, lewd, lascivious, filthy, excessively violent, harassing, or otherwise objectionable, whether or not such material is constitutionally protected. In a nutshell, it's this second part that gives social media companies the power to censor material on their sites. It's a shield that Silicon Valley's titans use today to regulate content on their websites in ways that go far beyond the scope of what Congress envisioned when it passed the Good Samaritan provision of that statute. According to former U.S. Congressman Chris Cox, Section 230's co-sponsor, the intent of the law was to empower social media companies to do things like prevent children from accessing pornography on the internet. Yet companies like Facebook and Twitter have used that same protection to prevent American adults from reading or sending certain articles in major newspapers that were critical of a leading candidate for president of the United States in the weeks preceding an election. The key problem with Section 230 isn't just the statute itself, but the abuse of the statute by companies. Indeed, that's the feature that bothers most politicians who call for the repeal of Section 230 today. In 2020, President Trump tweeted, "Revoke 230," after certain of his other tweets were flagged by Twitter as potentially misleading. Josh Hawley introduced a bill that same year aiming to end Section 230 protections for technology companies unless they agreed on an independent audit to ensure they were moderating content without political bias. He posted the following on Twitter, ironically enough. "It's pretty simple. If Twitter and Google and the rest are going to editorialize and censor and act like traditional publishers, they should be treated like traditional publishers and stop receiving the special carve-out from the federal government in Section 230. Interestingly, the movement to scrap Section 230 has become increasingly bipartisan, with even President Joe Biden suggesting a repeal of the statute. Silicon Valley's defenders of Section 230 claim that social media companies like Facebook and Twitter could have never gotten off the ground in a big way if they were also responsible for fighting lawsuits from angry users who sue those companies for being defamed on their sites. But that may have been a good thing for society. We ought to prefer a society in which no individual social media company is any larger or more powerful than an ordinary publisher. In that world, there would be multiple social media companies, each with different offerings, that each reach a smaller base of users, akin to a fragmented media marketplace with a series of local newspapers. That's what the free market might have produced as an alternative equilibrium, and it's one that sounds pretty good to me." That should be our greatest learning of all. We would have never had behemoth corporate monsters in Silicon Valley wielding the power that they do without laws that were a product of Silicon Valley's own lobbying efforts. In an ultimate irony, Jack Dorsey, in his Senate testimony, invoked that very fact in arguing against the repeal of Section 230. He warned that if Section 230 were to disappear, then only massive tech companies capable of shouldering the financial burdens associated with new legal liabilities would continue to exist, choking out smaller companies and startups that try to compete. It would leave only a small number of giant and well-funded technology companies, he testified. Dorsey's lack of self-awareness is laughable. The only way that current Silicon Valley behemoths ever became behemoths was due to the existence of Section 230 in the first place. But this is at best a learning for the future. Unfortunately, in one narrow sense, Dorsey is right. A repeal of the law is probably too little, too late, and may even do more harm than good, given that the network effects already enjoyed by the larger incumbents like Facebook and Twitter would only be strengthened by making it even more costly for other startups to reach their scale and reach, even if Section 230 was a mistake when it was passed in 1996. Congress opened Pandora's box, and it may be too late to shut it. But in the original myth, opening Pandora's box didn't just release a flood of evils into the world. The last thing left in the box was hope. So what's the solution? Antitrust law misses the point. Breaking up big tech companies won't stop smaller companies from still behaving like an ideological cartel. Regulation is self-defeating because large firms are expert at capturing the process for their own benefit, entrenching their status as incumbents. Repealing Section 230 would have the same effect, since larger firms are better able to withstand liability as compared to smaller upstarts. A more promising solution, at least in theory, would be for Congress to amend Section 230 in the following manner. Any company that benefits from Section 230 is bound by the standards of the First Amendment. In other words, internet service providers would have a choice. Either they could benefit from the extraordinary privilege of legal immunity against lawsuits from users alleging censorship while abiding by the First Amendment, or they could moderate and censor user content as they wish, but without the special shield of Section 230. They can't have both. Intellectually, it makes sense. If the federal government gives you special treatment, then you assume special obligations to act according to the same constitutional restraints as the federal government. Practically, though, it's nearly impossible to imagine Congress actually acting so boldly, especially when dollars from large corporate donors are still like mother's milk for most congressmen. In the near term, our most promising solution rests in the judicial system, the one institution that nearly all Americans still trust. In response to the widespread social media bans in January of 2021, I argued in the Wall Street Journal, along with my former law professor, that when big tech companies engage in selective censorship of political viewpoints on their platforms, these companies should be treated as state actors and bound by the Constitution under existing legal doctrines. No new laws are required. The legal argument is a bit of a mind-bender, but it's also a game-changer, so bear with me. Conventional wisdom holds that technology companies are free to regulate content because they're private, and the First Amendment protects only against government censorship. But that view is wrong. In reality, Congress co-opted Silicon Valley to do through the back door what government cannot directly accomplish under the Constitution. And it did it through a carrot-and-stick approach. Section 230 was the carrot, in that it not only permits tech companies to censor constitutionally protected speech, but completely shields them from federal or state liability for doing so. Yet the Supreme Court has long held that the legal provision of such immunity can turn private action into state action. Take Norwood v. Harrison, 1973, which held that it is axiomatic that the government may not induce, encourage, or promote private persons to accomplish what it is constitutionally forbidden to accomplish. Similarly, in Railway Employees Department v. Hansen, 1956, the justices found state action in closed shop agreements between private unions and the employer, which forced all employees to join the union because Congress had passed a statute immunizing such agreements from liability under state law. In Skinner v. Railway Labor Executives Association, 1989, the court yet again found state action in private party conduct, drug tests for company employees, because federal regulations immunized railroads from liability if they conducted those tests. In all of these cases, as with Section 230, the federal government didn't mandate anything. It merely preempted state law, protecting certain private parties from lawsuits if they engaged in the conduct Congress was promoting. If Section 230 is the carrot, here's the stick. Congressional Democrats have repeatedly made explicit threats to social media giants if they failed to censor speech those lawmakers disfavored. In April 2019, Louisiana Congressman Cedric Richmond warned Facebook and Google that they had better restrict what he and his colleagues saw as harmful content or face regulation. "We're going to make it swift. We're going to make it strong, and we're going to hold them very accountable." He added ominously, "Figure it out, because you don't want us to figure it out for you." New York Congressman Gerald Nadler added, "Let's see what happens by just pressuring them." The threats have worked. In September 2019, the day before another congressional grilling was to begin, Facebook announced important new restrictions on hate speech. It was no coincidence that big tech took its most aggressive steps against Trump just as Democrats were poised to take control of the White House and the Senate. Prominent Democrats promptly voiced approval of big tech's actions, which Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal expressly attributed to a change in the political winds. Our courts have long held that government threats can turn private conduct into state action, and with good reason. In Bantam Books, Inc. v. Sullivan, 1963, the Supreme Court found a First Amendment violation when a private bookseller stopped selling works state officials deemed objectionable after they sent him a veiled threat of prosecution. In Carlin Communications, Inc. v. Mountain States Telephone and Telegraph Company, 1987, the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals found state action when an official induced a telephone company to stop carrying offensive content, again by threat of prosecution. As the Second Circuit held in Hammerhead Enterprises v. Brezhnev, 1983, the test is whether comments of a government official can be reasonably interpreted as intimating that some form of punishment or adverse regulatory action will follow the failure to exceed the official's request. Richmond's comments and Nadler's comments easily meet that test. So do those of many other lawmakers and regulators. Notably, the Ninth Circuit held it didn't matter whether the threats were the real motivating force behind the private party's conduct. State action exists, even if he would have acted as he did independently. So even if you think that Jack Dorsey and Mark Zuckerberg aren't frightened of these mere mortal congressmen, the Supreme Court says it doesn't matter. The legal doctrine applies just the same. Either Section 230 or congressional pressure alone might be sufficient to create state action. But the combination has to be. Suppose a Republican-controlled Congress enacted a statute giving legal immunity to any private party that obstructs access to abortion clinics. Suppose further that Republican politicians explicitly threatened private companies with punitive laws if they fail to act against abortion clinics. If those same companies did as Congress demanded and then got a pat on the back from lawmakers like Blumenthal gave the social media companies, progressives would instantly see the constitutional problem. Or try a different example. Say Congress wants to look through the email of every corporate executive in the country. There's no constitutional mechanism for Congress to accomplish that directly. But it could simply pass the Email Decency Act, which immunizes any hacker from all legal liability for breaking into corporate email servers and transferring corporate executives' email logs into public databases, and prosecute hackers for their other crimes if they don't also break into those corporate email servers and publicize the executives' emails. If that sounds ridiculous, think again. That's exactly what Congress did with Section 230 of the Telecommunications Decency Act, combined with its severe threats to social media companies to censor speech on their sites. The left wing of Congress, unwittingly aided by some right-wing populists, effectively dispatched social media companies to do speech censoring work that the First Amendment prohibits Congress from doing directly. These social media companies are effectively privately hired censoring agents for the government. This ought to be an affront to any American who cares about the integrity of our Constitution. It reminds me of the premise underlying season 5 of the television series Homeland. German intelligence agencies were prohibited by new German privacy laws from spying on their citizens. So instead, they invited the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency onto their soil to do the spying on their behalf. In return, the CIA got to keep the private information of German citizens for its own purposes. It's strikingly similar to what's happening now in the real world with social media companies. Substitute the U.S. government for the German intelligence agencies, Twitter and Facebook for the CIA, and the analogy becomes clear. These corporate behemoths are doing the work of big government under the mantle of private enterprise, and they're getting away with it together. It's the most dangerous kind of woke capitalism of all. The kind where the government explicitly co-opts private institutions to do the government's own bidding. As we've discussed, the unholy marriage between government and corporations isn't just hypothetical, nor is it hyperbole. In fact, it may soon have a name. New York University researchers have published a report titled False Accusation: The Unfounded Claim That Social Media Companies Censor Conservatives, which calls for the Biden administration to form a new digital regulatory agency to fight dangerous ideas, such as the assertion that social media companies have anti-conservative bias. Remind you of Orwell's Ministry of Truth? Well, it gets worse. According to the New York Times, we now have a reality crisis. The solution? Experts are calling for the administration to put together a cross-agency task force to tackle disinformation and domestic extremism, which would be led by something like a reality czar. Importantly, this task force could also meet regularly with tech platforms and push for structural changes that could help those companies tackle their own extremism and misinformation problems. It could become the tip of the spear for the federal government's response to the reality crisis. Others are calling for a truth commission. For anyone who's still wary of my argument that big tech censorship is state action disguised as private action, don't take it from me. Just listen to America's newspaper of record. In sum, here's how the game was played. First, Congress endowed big tech with the special corporate privilege of Section 230 that immunizes technology companies from any liability in state court for censoring or otherwise regulating user content. Second, liberal congressmen threatened those same companies at hearings in 2020, saying that if they failed to remove hate speech from white nationalists, they would be punished. Third, liberal lawmakers congratulate social media companies after they go on to censor the content that Democrats don't like. Fourth, tech titans managed to take their most aggressive actions of all, just as Democrats are poised to take control of the White House, the Senate, and the House of Representatives for the first time in over a decade. And fifth, of course, Silicon Valley billionaires made staggeringly one-sided campaign contributions to those same Democratic candidates as a token of appeasement. In 2020, the mantra of keeping money out of politics was no longer a liberal slogan. Instead, blending profits with politics, and ultimately power, became the new progressive way. We've devolved from a three-branch federal government to one with a headquarters in Silicon Valley and a branch office in Washington, D.C., each doing precisely the work that the other can't. That's the backroom bargain that defines our century. When I was a kid growing up in Ohio, my favorite field trip was the one that we took to Washington, D.C. I still remember my awe when I saw the dome of the U.S. Capitol for the first time. We used to visit the various memorials. We learned how to do a proper salute, just like they do in the military. Perhaps one day my son will feel the same way when his teachers take him on a trip to see the glassy exterior of the Googleplex offices in Silicon Valley. I doubt they'll make him salute the CEO. Maybe they'll have him bow instead. Chapter 10. Wokeness is like a religion. I read my favorite story about Christ during my junior year at St. Xavier High School in a poem contained in the last book Fyodor Dostoevsky wrote before he died, The Brothers Karamazov. Here's how I remember it. The story begins with Jesus Christ returning to earth during the Spanish Inquisition. He shows up in Seville and starts performing biblical miracles, healing the lame and the sick. But when an old cardinal recognizes him, instead of celebrating Christ's return, he has him arrested. The Inquisition's leaders sentence Christ to be burned to death the next day. The Grand Inquisitor shows up in Christ's prison cell and gives an extended explanation of how Christ's return stands in the way of the Church's mission. The Grand Inquisitor begins by reminding Jesus of the three temptations the devil offered him in the desert, taking the devil's side and arguing that Christ was wrong to reject each of them for the sake of keeping his freedom. Freedom, claims the Grand Inquisitor, is an obstacle to salvation, not the pathway to it. He says that instead of extolling the virtues of free will, Jesus should have won people's hearts by turning stone to bread and feeding them, should have gained their worship by casting himself down from the mountain to be lifted up by angels, and should have ensured their salvation by ruling all the kingdoms of earth. The theme of the Grand Inquisitor's soliloquy is that the Church has outgrown Christ. He agrees with Christ's goal of delivering salvation, but he says that people can't be trusted to make the right decisions. They have to be forced to be good. In the Inquisitor's eyes, all men are sinners, and the duty of the Church is to compel them to recognize their sin so they can be saved. Jesus' message of free will interferes with that project because, fallen as they are, most people will only choose to fall further into sin. Christ has value only as a symbol whose name and likeness the Church can invoke to make people obey. But Jesus himself is obsolete, says the Grand Inquisitor. Jesus must die so that what he has come to represent can live on. When I reflected on Roivant, wokeness, and the state of our nation on Juneteenth, 2020, I remembered the Grand Inquisitor. Diversity has become a term of art, a symbol, one so powerful that the symbol is now more important than the thing it was supposed to represent. Wokeness sacrifices true diversity, diversity of thought, so that skin-deep symbols of diversity, like race and gender, can thrive. Just like Christ in the story, true diversity of thought now represents a threat to the Church of diversity. So this Church didn't make us forget the true God. It sentenced the true God to death. Columbia University linguistics professor John McWhorter has observed that third wave anti-racism is a profoundly religious movement in everything but terminology. He couldn't be more right. Diversity experts like Ibram Kendi and Robin DiAngelo are the grand inquisitors of our time. Corporate CEOs are the followers in the square who kneel to them. Some of them kneel out of worship, some out of fear, some a mixture of the two. If they confess themselves to be sinners and acknowledge their racism and sexism, the inquisitors will absolve them of these sins. Corporate employees and their consumers are like the innocent masses, left to worship at the temple of diversity, a quasi-religion that monolithically rejects diversity itself, just as the commoners in Seville worshipped at a church that sentenced Christ to execution. "Heal me of my patriarchy," the woke CEOs and their employees cry. "I am blind to my white privilege. Make me see." If they show a penitent heart and a contrite spirit, the diversity experts graciously bless them and then move on to their next speaking engagement. All must be saved. Robin DiAngelo is the author of White Fragility, which you can find on the bookcase of every woke suburban mom. It topped the bestseller lists in 2020. DiAngelo presents an overly simplified view of race in America, which paints whites as a racist monolith that systemically oppresses blacks and other minority groups. As the Washington Post describes it, DiAngelo believes that whites are an undifferentiated racist collective, socialized to fundamentally hate blackness and to institutionalize that prejudice in politics and culture. DiAngelo's rise is emblematic of the increased adoption of a previously fringe school of thought that has now spread across corporate America through mandated diversity trainings and has even made its way into exhibits at the Smithsonian. DiAngelo and her devotees seem to believe that things like the scientific method, use of the written word, punctuality, and hard work are hallmarks of whiteness, and that it perpetuates white supremacy for her employers and teachers to valorize them. In DiAngelo's telling, the idea of meritocracy is a white supremacist myth meant to justify existing racial hierarchies as the product of hard work. One journalist interviewing DiAngelo questioned her about her objection to the supposedly white practice of hiring professors based on how rational they are. The journalist asked whether hiring rational teachers might produce rational students. DiAngelo ultimately responded that if any practice leads to the outcome of minorities doing poorly, that practice must be racist. She then noted, incidentally, that under capitalism, minorities do poorly. The reasoning doesn't seem airtight to me, but this is the stuff of which diversity seminars are built. Coca-Cola made the news recently when some images leaked of a DiAngelo diversity training course it had its employees take on LinkedIn. She instructed them to try to be less white and said that amounts to being less oppressive, arrogant, defensive, ignorant, and so on. I took a look at the training course and noted DiAngelo added that Asians are guilty of these sins too because they're white adjacent. This jargon-based racism about Asians being white adjacent is increasingly common in woke circles, as a recent Wall Street Journal op-ed explains. Coca-Cola responded to the controversy over DiAngelo's diversity training with some corporate legalese, saying it was not a focus of our company's curriculum. LinkedIn quietly took down the course. Robin DiAngelo's shtick is that she's a white person who tells her fellow white people they're racists and gives them verbal flails they can whip themselves with to atone. And she charges a pretty penny for her service. White fragility is essentially a modern-day hair shirt. As far as I can tell, the phenomenon of white fragility refers to white people not liking being called racist. You'll find more of the same in Ibram Kendi's work on diversity, though without the nauseating self-flagellation you can only find in woke white people. One of his recent books is called How to Be an Anti-Racist. In it, he makes assertions such as the claim of not racist neutrality is a mask for racism. So if you claim to be racist, you obviously are. If you claim not to be racist, you're hiding your racism, which is even worse. It's a woke catch-22. It turns out that one of diversity's central tenets is that everyone is racist, just as part of Catholicism is accepting that everyone is a sinner. Don't get me wrong. True diversity is very valuable, both for our nation and for a company. But it's diversity of thought that's supposed to matter, not a kind of diversity crudely measured by appearance or accent. At some point, we all started using superficial qualities as proxies for intellectual diversity. But the more we focused on those proxies for intellectual diversity, the less we cared about the thing the proxies were supposed to represent. Just as Jesus had become a threat to the institution of the church in Dostoevsky's tale, intellectual diversity had become a threat to American corporations, universities, and other institutions. Just as the Grand Inquisitor sentenced Jesus to execution, today's corporate stewards sacrifice intellectual diversity at their corporate altars in the name of a new diversity. As I chafed at the new regime of diversity that has taken root across corporate America, I also found myself thinking about an email I'd just gotten from one of my employees after groups of employees across the company self-organized to have honest discussions about race after the murder of George Floyd and the resulting aftermath. As CEO, I even joined a few of them and assumed that the conversations were just that, honest. But I soon found out we'd really only had the illusion of honesty. As it turns out, in public, everyone says the same things. I started to receive a dribble of feedback from employees who'd felt afraid to say what they really thought. One email gnawed at me in particular, this one from one of the few who was willing to reveal his identity. He started out by praising the company's diversity and its purpose of developing medicines. I encouraged him to share his thoughts at our next town hall. What he said in response stuck with me. "Thank you for the invitation to talk on that. However, I'm uncomfortable doing that. One part of my experience is that many years ago, I realized that some media outlets and people in general see a white male and immediately label that person as a racist or a bigot. While I don't have a racist bone in my body, I'm uncomfortable talking publicly about our diversity." I didn't realize until seeing his email that our honest conversation about race had been governed by an implicit hierarchy based on perceived diversity. Maybe some of his coworkers didn't see him as diverse, and maybe his fellow citizens didn't either. But he'd been diverse to me all along. I saw a diversity of identities within him alone, a Southern Christian man who was devoutly committed to science and developing new medicines. Our little episode last spring was a trifle compared to the experiences of other companies at home and abroad. For instance, in 2019, Nike planned to unveil a new sneaker for the 4th of July, a red, white, and blue one that had a picture of the Betsy Ross flag on the back, which features 13 stripes alternating between red and white, and 13 white stars in a circle on a blue background. It made the shoe and shipped them, and then suddenly recalled them all. Why? Because Colin Kaepernick had recently signed onto its payroll, and he argued that because the flag design was created in 1776 and slavery was legal at the time, Nike would have been endorsing slavery. This quickly became the accepted wisdom. Democratic political candidates rushed to endorse Nike's move, and Betsy Ross's flag became known as a symbol of white supremacy overnight. So what had been intended to be a celebration of women's contributions to the creation of the nation became viewed as a threat to diversity. Forbidden words are also a threat to diversity, even when you're quoting them, not using them. Prominent science reporter Donald McNeil was recently ousted from the New York Times for uttering the N-word when answering a high school student's question about whether a classmate deserved to be suspended for saying that word. Tim Boudreau, the chair of Central Michigan University's journalism department, was fired merely for quoting a leading free speech case that itself mentioned the N-word in its description of the facts. Greg Patton, a communications professor at the University of Southern California, was recently suspended when he mentioned a Chinese word that sounded like the N-word to some students. Forbidden hand gestures are an affront to diversity, too. Emmanuel Cafferty, a Latino man who was fired from his job as a truck driver, found that out the hard way. His sin? Imperiling diversity by, I'm not joking, making the OK sign with his fingers. Here's what happened. At a traffic stop, another driver flipped him off, made the OK symbol, and yelled at Cafferty to copy him. Confused, Cafferty did, hoping that would end the encounter.